This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, hosting its 22nd anniversary celebration and the grand opening of Gazelle Full Circle Resale, also featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Both events run June 16th through 25th. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont. Information at 503-288-3422.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Gelda.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, more news on Oregonians in Iraq, then more news in one Oregonian trying to stay out of it. The rift between majority public opinion and the majority in Congress, both Democratic and Republican, on Iraq is growing. It's bringing new faces and strategies to the game of electoral politics. Internal memo from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad leaked to the Washington Post reveals that the situation in the Iraqi capital is far more dire than portrayed by the Bush administration, and is probably the reason for Bush's surprise visit last week.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,504 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. And in IraqBodyCount.org reports 42,889 civilians have been reported killed by the military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate that the true civilian toll may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 19th, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierra with Cosmo, the radio dog. Army Specialist Robert Jones, a 2002 graduate of Rex Putnam High School in Milwaukee, died last Friday in an ambush in Iraq. A family friend told reporters Jones was on a foot patrol in Baghdad when he and two other soldiers were lured into a booby trap. Jones was hit by mortar and he died instantly. Jones is the 59th soldier with ties to Oregon to die in the so-called War on Terror in the Middle East. Jones, who was called Bobby, wished his father, Jerry Dole, a happy Father's Day and told him he loved him in a letter that arrived Thursday. In the letter, Jones said he couldn't find his Father's Day's card for him. Jones struggled through high school and joined the military because he wanted to serve his country and to get help paying for college, said a family friend.
An Oregon man from Madras is one of the two Army soldiers seen kidnapped in Iraq after an attack at a checkpoint. Missing are Army Privates First Class Thomas Lowell Tucker, age 25, of Madras, Oregon, and 23-year-old Christian Manacha of Houston, Texas. The Defense Department said Specialist David J. Babineau, age 25, of Springfield, Massachusetts, was killed in the attack. All three soldiers were assigned to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Witnesses said that after an explosion by a roadside bomb, the two soldiers, the sole survivors of the attack, were seen being led away by armed men. Kay Fristad, an Oregon National Guard spokesman, said she had a brief conversation with Tucker's parents, and they said that he joined the military to do something positive for the country. Former Madras Mayor Rick Allen, whom Tucker worked for at a gas station while he was a student at Madras High School, described Tucker as strong, street smart, and mechanically inclined.
A group tied to Al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility today for kidnapping the two U.S. soldiers. Coalition military spokesman Major General William Caldwell says the Army is enlisting all its resources in its search for the two missing soldiers.
We have surged intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms and employed planes, boats, helicopters, and UAVs to ensure the most thorough search possible.
And that was Major General William Caldwell of the Coalition Authority in Baghdad.
Army Specialist Suzanne Swift plans a press conference in Seattle tomorrow with her attorney and Lieutenant Colonel Ann Wright. Also attending will be Swift's mother, Sarah Rich, a Eugene resident. Wright resigned from the U.S. Foreign Service on March 19, 2003, while serving as Deputy Chief of Mission at the embassy in Mongolia because of her disagreement with the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Iraq. Wright will discuss the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder on soldiers and the need for justice in the Swift case. Swift, who's AWOL from the Army, was placed under arrest on a federal warrant Sunday, June 11th. Swift refuses to return to Iraq because of what she described as extreme post-traumatic stress disorder and arrest caused by sexual harassment at the hands of three of her commanding officers, including sexual coercion. The press conference is tomorrow at noon at the University Lutheran Church at 1604 Northeast 50th Street in Seattle, Washington.
About 400 bicyclists and bike activists congregated in Portland Saturday morning for a bike summit. It was hosted by the city's Department of Transportation. The event was part of the city's Go Platinum campaign. It's an effort to be the first major city to receive the top ranking by the American League of Bicyclists. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has the story.
Portland, not just the best city in the country, leaving Davis in our dust.
Evan Manville, executive director of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. He's referring to Davis, California, the only city currently ranked platinum. Saturday's summit was intended to highlight what's being done in the city to promote cycling and to give citizens a chance to participate in planning future innovations. Speakers included City Transportation Commissioner Sam Adams, who's been a proponent of the Go Platinum campaign.
We want to build a city to be the kind of city where you can have a life without having a car and having a bike.
Another speaker was Congressman Earl Blumenauer, a longtime cycling advocate.
The bicycle is the most efficient form of urban transportation ever designed.
Also present was Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder, who is a founding member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. He says the BTA came into existence during the Persian Gulf War when people in Portland started talking about ways to lessen dependence on oil.
We are in another war. 2,500 American soldiers have died in that war so far. I don't know how many thousands of Iraqis have died in that war. It is a war over resources. And those war over resources will continue as long as we are dependent on other people's resources to keep our lifestyles going. Bikes offer one of those solutions.
Burkholder says that in the face of dwindling oil supplies, we need to redesign our cities and transportation systems. Congressman Blumenauer says transforming a modern city like Portland isn't as hard as some people think.
Because of the excesses of some of our friends who were traffic engineers of an earlier era, we have built to standards that are just plain goofy. But it means we've got a lot of asphalt and concrete and right-of-way. And American cities, in the main, harken back a century ago where three of the major forms of movement were pedestrian, streetcar, and bicycling. So that's the core of Portland and Cincinnati and Buffalo. So we've got a lot of raw material that we have here to gain access to.
Evan Manville of the BTA says Portland can follow the example of the Netherlands, where as many as 40% of trips are made by bike. He says that country's reliance on bicycles stems from policy decisions.
Dutch political leaders in the early 1970s totaled up all it would cost to keep building car infrastructure and keep preventing congestion and do all that, and they realized they couldn't afford it. And they were strong enough to make a different decision and start investing their money in a serious way in different things.
Manville says there's no inherent difference between the Dutch and Portlanders. The more the city invests in bike infrastructure, the more its citizens will ride. Mia Burke says Portland has made huge strides since the mid-90s.
We have seen bicycling increase dramatically in the city, from a few thousand cyclists across the four main bridges in downtown to over 10,000 cyclists per day going across the bridges.
A report released last week found that the cycling industry in Portland generates $63 million in economic activity and an estimated 800 jobs. After the morning speeches and slideshows, summit-goers chose between 15 workshops to attend. At one workshop, participants wrote on maps with Sharpies circling areas that are dangerous or difficult by bike. But people also recognized many improvements that have been made over the years.
More signage, more lanes, more boulevards, just more critical mass, I guess. It's not like a fringe thing. It's like, oh, we're in the Oregonian. Oh, there's, you know, I think they said there were something like 2,100 events a year here. So it's just sort of, it's Portland normal now. Everybody kind of accepts that it's here, even if they're cranky about it.
In July, the Portland Department of Transportation will start the public process to put together a new bike master plan. The development process will involve input from thousands of Portlanders over the next 2 years. I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
Firefighters in Southern Oregon rescued a small fawn from an abandoned mine shaft over the weekend. The fawn had fallen about 20 feet into the mine as it had fled from a dog. Firefighters lowered Applegate Fire Lieutenant Cody Goodenough into the mine to fetch the fawn, which was perched on a pile of debris. Once the two emerged from the shaft unharmed, the fawn was returned to the woods. Firefighters were familiar with the mine after rescuing a Labrador that had fallen down the same shaft in 2003. Jacksonville firefighters said they plan to recommend that the mine be plugged.
And more on our animal friends. A fire forced an evacuation of animals and staff yesterday afternoon from the Dove Lewis Emergency Animal Hospital, which reopened at, say, 7 a.m. today. Smoke from a fire in a commercial laundry dryer prompted the evacuation from the Northwest Portland facility. No animals or people were hurt. About 20 dogs and cats and one bird were transferred from the hospital on Northwest Pettigrove Street to the agency's administration building next door.
A grassroots petition to expand Oregon's prescription drug program has less than a month to go to gather the necessary signatures. The measures would provide coverage for nearly 750,000 legal residents who currently have no coverage. KBOO's Rich Rochelle Koivunen reports.
Dr. Helen Caldicott is a KBOO supporter. Let's hear what she has to say about community radio.
Well, I think it's extremely important because how else are the public going to hear the truth and hear about controversial issues? The media in general do not talk about the things that threaten.
With less than a month to go, supporters of Initiative 122 are confident they'll get the required number of signatures to put the measure on the ballot. The initiative would expand the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, which saves people as much as 60% on drug costs. Currently, participants have to meet strict conditions to participate. Jerry Cohen with AARP Oregon says eliminating those restrictions would ease the burden for 750,000 Oregonians who have no coverage.
By taking away age, waiting period, and income guidelines, this initiative shatters barriers to low-cost prescription medication at no additional cost or expense to taxpayers.
Supporters are relying on a unique grassroots mail-in effort as well as rallies across the state, including two in Bend and Medford next week, to gather the signatures needed to put the initiative on November's ballot. They have until July 7th to submit the signatures. Jerry Cohen with AARP Oregon says Oregon is already having success with its purchasing program, and giving more people access makes sense, especially with 1 in 5 Oregonians currently lacking coverage.
It's really something that Oregon has been doing that the federal government can and should be doing, which is having a large pool to negotiate and use the marketplace for leveraging prices to bring them down.
I'm Rochelle Koivunen, KBOO News.
Should state money that is set aside to pay for lawyers for the poor also be used to lobby for the poor in the Washington State Legislature? And that's the question the State Supreme Court's Rules Committee would take up at a July 7th meeting in Olympia. The Farm Bureau is asking the court to restrict lobbying by the Columbia Legal Services. The Farm Bureau doesn't object to legal service, but it says it's wrong to use what amounts to tax money for political purposes, such as influencing legislation affecting farm workers. The Farm Bureau's proposal is opposed by the State Bar Association. Columbia Legal Services is a nonprofit law firm with 22 lawyers practicing in 5 offices around that state. Its money comes from a special program set up 22 years ago by the state Supreme Court. The money comes from interest on real estate escrow accounts. Columbia Legal spent $1.5 million last year on lawyers and $7,000 for legislative lobbying.
Several groups are planning to respond to a planned neo-Nazi rally on July 3rd in Olympia, Washington. The Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace plans to protest the National Socialist Movement at the scene on the steps of the Washington State Capitol. Another group is taking a more less confrontational approach. Unity in the Community is organizing a series of events to raise awareness and support for multiculturalism, including Diversity Festival, July 2nd in Sylvester Park downtown. John Brandt of the Snohomish County National Socialist Movement says he hopes his group's message can be heard and that he can change some minds as well.
The number of immigrants in detention in the United States continues to rise, and it could be propelled even further with the passage of so-called border security provisions in the immigration bill, which is still being hammered out in Congress. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The number of asylum seekers coming to the United States has decreased since September 11, 2001. The reason, in part, is because the U.S. has used the threat of mandatory and prolonged detention of asylum seekers as a deterrent. Pascal Wani Akame is one of those asylum seekers. He came to the United States in November of 2004 from Cameroon, where he was detained and tortured for voicing opposition to the government's human rights abuses. Once he landed at a U.S. airport, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol detained him.
I asked myself a question. Am I really in detention, as I was in my country, forsaken for help? Or have I done something else I don't know that maybe must have been attributed to me ignorantly or innocently? I had a lot of questions in my mind. But I left from detention camps, detention facilities to another. I began understanding that it was not really my only problem. It was a problem of many others that I met in those detention facilities.
Akame was transferred from Allen Road Detention Facility to Hampton Road Jail, where he stayed for 3 months.
I kept asking myself questions. Is asking for asylum a crime in the U.S.?
He sought legal representation and was released on parole. Nearly a year later, in October of 2005, Akame was granted asylum.
How ironic that many of them are jailed in immigration jails in the very nation they have fled to in search of protection.
Eleanor Acer is the director of Human Rights First's asylum program. But asylum seekers aren't the only ones who have been affected by U.S. detention. Migrants have as well. 22,000 people languish in 200 detention centers each day, numbers which have grown when U.S. policy expanded the culture of detention, beginning with the Anti-Terrorism Act and the Immigration Nationality Act, both of which were signed into law by President Clinton in 1996. Policymakers continue to use detention as a way to deal with immigration and the threat of stalled in House and Senate negotiations. Measures would further expedite removal of and increase mandatory detention for asylum seekers and immigrants alike. It would also
increase prolonged and indefinite detention by aiming to overturn a Supreme Court decision that limits the length of detention.
Again, Eleanor Acer.
And add detention beds, the House bill adding about 10,000 and the Senate bill 20,000, potentially.
It is still unclear from where the funding for the new facilities will come. To further crack down on immigration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is 1 week into Operation Return to Sender, a program that has rounded up more than 2,000 undocumented immigrants who have been in the United States for less than 14 days. 800 of those have already been deported to their country of origin. The rest are in detention centers. Michael Kagan is public affairs officer with ICE. He says detention is necessary to crack down on immigration.
We're streamlining our bed space rotations. And like I mentioned, we are deporting individuals within 20 days to, you know, no more than 30 days. That is extremely fast comparing to the past, which was about 90 days. So these bed spaces are rotating a lot faster, giving us more room to arrest more individuals. Additionally, too, we have just recently increased our bed space from 19,000 to 22,000.
U.S. policy on detention has influenced a broad coalition of opposition. They say alternatives are possible. Ralston Deffenbaugh, Jr., the president of the Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service in Baltimore, is a member of this coalition.
Take the most vulnerable out of detention, especially asylum seekers. Give each person in detention basic due process. And lastly, limit immigration detention to its narrow purpose.
In the emergency supplemental that passed Congress last week, $1.9 billion went to border security. A portion of that money will be used to build detention facilities and increase the number of beds by 4,000. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The rift between majority public opinion and majority in Congress, both Democrat and Republican alike, on Iraq is bringing new faces and strategies to the game of electoral politics. Liberal Democrats are running against incumbent Beltway Democrats and Green Party candidate against incumbent Republicans. Martha Baskin takes a look at our electoral politics and the strategies for change in November.
Michael Berg, father of Nicholas Berg, who was beheaded in Iraq 2 years ago when news of U.S. torture at Abu Ghraib prison first surfaced, is by his own account an unlikely politician. The retired remedial education teacher and longtime pacifist is the Green Party candidate for Congress in Delaware. Berg is running against Republican incumbent Mike Castle, who supports the war. But most importantly, says Berg, he's in the race because he holds the Bush administration responsible for his son's death and wants to stop the cycle of revenge. Why is he running as a Green? Democrats don't support the issues he cares about either. Ending the war, corporate influence peddling, single-payer health care, well-funded public schools, and removing the ceiling on Social Security wages, which favor the well-off.
Senator Biden, Joe Biden, who is here in Delaware, announced himself as the peace candidate, and then he goes and he votes to fund the war. The Democrat that's running against Mike Castle, his name is Dennis Bivick, he calls himself a peace candidate, but he thinks it's irresponsible to end the war now. I think it's irresponsible to let it go on another 12 minutes, because in another 12 minutes, another person is going to die over there.
The Green Party calls its 2006 national slate of candidates the peace slate. The platform for these dangerous Greens, as a press release refers to them, calls for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney for crimes committed in office. Nationally, Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton and California's Dianne Feinstein are being challenged by Green candidates. At a Seattle fundraiser for Katrina victims, Aaron Dixon, the only African-American Green Party candidate running for U.S. Senate, says the U.S. has only one political party.
We in this country, we only have one party. That's the Democratic Republican Party. And we are tired of them waging war in our name. We're tired of them killing innocent civilians in our name. We're tired of them using torture and brutality in our name. And we're tired of them starving our children, not giving our children the food that they need. We're tired of them not providing the decent housing for our people.
A former Black Panther, Dixon says his goals now are the same as they were 35 years ago, creating a better world, a world that treats everyone with respect, as he puts it, and one that is humane to all its citizens. Dixon's opponent, Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell, is a tough love choice for progressives. She's against drilling in the Arctic and has fought Enron on behalf of the public utility, but she remains committed to the Bush administration's stay-the-course policy in Iraq. Iraqi war vets, family members of those killed, and others have taken to waging sit-ins in Cantwell's office. Organizer of the sit-ins, Howard Gale, agrees that there are both tactical and electoral choices to be made. Work for a progressive caucus within the Democratic Party or turn to another party.
And those are strategic questions, and I think that has to be separated out from what's a moral question, which is what activists have to ask themselves. The moral question is concerns the fact that this war is unjust and immoral. And if it's unjust and immoral, we have to oppose it, and we have to at least make transparent the positions of our congresspeople and senators.
Gale admits that trying to change the opinion of an incumbent is a separate task from deciding whether to step outside the confines of the two-party system altogether. But those promoting a third-party candidate think that this strategy is a waste of time. Mike Gillis, Green Party candidate Aaron Dixon's press secretary, says lobbying Cantwell on Iraq is slightly less useless than trying to lobby George Bush.
The Green option, what it really says is that you don't have to vote for her. It's really the only meaningful way to create pressure. The only term that people like Cantwell think of is in the ability to keep her job. And as long as you say, oh, I hate what you're doing, you need to change this, but I'll vote for you anyways. That gives them no reason to give you what you want, because, you know, why buy the cow if you get the vote for free?
It's a question those opposed to the Iraq war will have to ask themselves in November. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting from Seattle.
The Associated Press reports today that a Pentagon document classifies homosexuality as a mental disorder, decades after mental health researchers abandoned that position. The document outlines retirement or other discharge policies for U.S. service members with physical disabilities, and in a section on defects, it lists homosexuality alongside mental disabilities and so-called personality disorders. Pentagon spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy M. Martin said the policy document is still under review. There were 726 military members discharged under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy during the budget year that ended last September 30th. That marked the first year since 2001 that the total had increased. The number of discharges had declined each year since it peaked at 1,227 in 2001 and had fallen to about 653 in 2004.
Thousands of U.S. and Iraqi troops have completely surrounded the Sunni city of Ramadi in Iraq. The new checkpoints were established on Saturday. The United Nations is reporting that nearly 10,000 residents of Ramadi have already fled the city, fearing a Fallujah-like assault. The U.S. military has played down talk of that type of campaign, saying the current operation was part of efforts to restore stability to Ramadi, 110 miles west of Baghdad. Residents say U.S. troops have not urged people to leave the town, the capital of Anbar province, heartland of the Sunni Arab insurgency, seeking to topple the Shiite-led government.
And now, live from Pennsylvania's prison death row, a commentary from Mamouya Abu Jamal.
Culture wars at the ebb of empire. In this, the silly season of American politics, we find ourselves in the midst of yet another culture war, or a politically imposed set of conflicts that seeks to find hot issues that will whip an increasingly apathetic populace into the voting booths. In 19th century Germany, the educated elite used the term Kulturkampf, which literally translates as culture struggle. In that age, the term referred to struggles between church and state as to which would control education. It now reflects the political struggles in the U.S. over issues of race, social mobility, sexuality, and gender. We saw it most recently in the aborted attempt to amend the U.S. Constitution to outlaw same-sex marriage, and also recent rap about a flag-burning amendment. Notably, none of these issues really addresses the day-to-day life of Americans. It doesn't open the scope of education, increase one's pay, protect one's pension, nor speak to the wrenching issues of war, peace, globalism, or the twilight of industrialism. In a nutshell, it doesn't put gas in the tank, nor is it supposed to. Politicians, as a rule, are poor conveyors of culture. While states have political leaders, these folks are rarely leaders of a nation's cultural life. Indeed, art, the realm of painting, sculpture, poetry, slams, dance, novels, are often quite at odds with the political world. The artist Pablo Picasso said, "Art is a lie that makes us realize the truth." In his painting Guernica, he showed the horrors of war and the evils of fascism. His work commemorates the 1937 Nazi destruction of the Basque city to support the fascist regime of General Francisco Franco, the dictator. His work speaks through time in ways that the speeches of politicians cannot. But truth be told, politics itself is an art, albeit a debased one. It is public performance that differs from the stage only in location and social impact. Its tools, or should I say props, are fear, division, separation, and the public manipulation of emotion. What else is the Iraq war? How else can we begin to explain its invasion, occupation, and the present nationalist cultural war that rages there? Indeed, much of the same can be said about the so-called Cold War, where two world empires, the Russians and the Americans, used others to serve as their proxies to wage war on their behalf. Yet ultimately, this isn't culture, for culture is the creative impulses of a people. It opens eyes to deep truths. It goes around political structures to reach the heart. Historian Howard Zinn, speaking of art's power, recently said, "The arts are the locale for a kind of guerrilla warfare. They're subtle, so the establishment gambles that they won't lead to anything threatening, but often they lose that gamble." Culture wars ain't just words used by politicians to mobilize support. They're waged at the level of the mind and the inner self. It is a way of creating new ways of looking at the world, and hopefully new ways of remaking the world. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The current time is 5:30:44, and now a rare voice of reason from Texas. Daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I hate to say I told you so, but let me just say one name to you, Sam Alito. When he was nominated by Bush last year to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court, practically the entire debate over this right-wing judge revolved around his stance on abortion. So, Alito and his backers worked hard to soften his record as a knee-jerk anti-choice zealot. Enough Senate Democrats and moderate Republicans were convinced, and he was confirmed. A few of us populists, however, tried to point out that the Supreme Court spends far more time on issues involving worker rights, pollution, consumers, and such, than on abortion. We warned that Alito had sided consistently with corporate and governmental elites over ordinary citizens on these issues throughout his legal career, and would do the same on the High Court. Sure enough, in his first opportunity to side with bosses over the First Amendment rights of workers, Alito jumped on it. In a May 30th decision involving a whistleblower, a bare 5-4 majority of the court ruled that public employees have no free speech right to blow the whistle against wrongdoing by their superiors, and they have no constitutional protection against retaliation by their bosses. The deciding vote came from Alito. Had Sandra Day O'Connor still been on the bench, it's likely that the court would have ruled the other way, for the rights of whistleblowers. Unfortunately, we're now stuck with this guy for life. The lesson here, especially for Democrats, is that future nominees to all of our courts need to be vetted not only on social issues, but also grilled equally hard on whose interests they'll serve on the economic, environmental, and civil liberties cases that come before them. This is Jim Hightower saying, to learn more about this particular case, call the National Whistleblower Center, 202-342-1902. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Your radio tuned for independent native news following our newscast at 6 p.m. tonight here, Labor Radio. At 7, Time Sound with Kevin Berry. The weather is going to be beautiful, it looks like, for the Willamette Valley. First being cloudy and then getting warmer every day. Today's high went to about 75 degrees, and for the Columbia Gorge, it's going to be sunnier and even warmer. Summer solstice is Wednesday. Party time. You are listening to the ever-handcrafted KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is preparing an environmental impact statement to determine if a Sierra Nevada stream can be poisoned in order to restore the threatened Paiute cutthroat trout. Pardon me. It's the fifth time in 4 years the government biologists are proposing to poison Silver King Creek south of Lake Tahoe to rid it of non-native fish to benefit the trout. Permits, problems, and opponents concerned about the use of the chemical rotenone in the pristine mountain creek have halted the project each of the last 4 years. Last summer, a team hiking into the wilderness to perform the task was ordered to turn around after a federal judge sided with the conservationists against the project. Fish and wildlife officials say an environmental impact statement could be completed by late summer.
Biotechnology corporate giant Monsanto is facing a joint legal action by several Indian states over its genetically engineered BT cotton seed. Binu Alex has more on this story.
Seven cotton-growing states in India and several civil society groups have joined forces against multinational seed giant Monsanto, but for different reasons. The former wants Monsanto to reduce its prices, but the latter wants a complete ban on the BT cotton seeds. The current action comes after Monsanto lost a legal battle in the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh over the high price of its patented BT cotton seed. The government maintains that it has nothing against the company, and its concern is that these technologies must reach the small and marginal farmers at a fair price. Activists fighting against genetic engineering cite different studies to claim that there has been no reduction in the use of pesticides and no increase in yields, as claimed by the company. But as these debates continue, India's biotech regulatory body has cleared Borgard 2, the latest Monsanto-manufactured variety of genetically modified cotton for commercial cultivation in the states of Gujarat, Maharashtra and Madhya Pradesh. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi marked her 64th birthday today alone and under house arrest. Her supporters around the world called for Burma's military government to free her. The military tightened security outside the barricaded home of Suu Kyi, leader of the National League for Democracy and the 1991 Nobel Peace Act, Peace Laureate. She spent 10 of the last 17 years in confinement, making her one of the world's most prominent political prisoners. In neighboring Thailand, Myanmar exiles held a small Buddhist religious ceremony in Bangkok, while in the Philippines, activists wearing chains and carrying a replica of a giant cake marched on Myanmar's embassy to demand her release. Protests also took place in India, Bangladesh, Italy, and elsewhere.
A group of pro-whaling nations has successfully lobbied the International Whaling Commission to pass a resolution that could lead to the return of commercial whaling. The measure, which passed by a margin of just one vote, called for a reversal of the 20-year ban. Japan has led the push to resume commercial whaling, and many opposed to the lifting of the ban say that Tokyo had used promises of aid to recruit countries to join its pro-whaling bloc. Of course, Japan denies this. Today's resolution does not overturn the 20-year moratorium on commercial whaling, which would require a two-thirds majority, but it does demonstrate the massively growing influence of the pro-whaling bloc at the International Whaling Commission.
The United Nations says poor people living in towns and cities are often worse off than those living in rural areas. The findings of the report by UN Habitat challenges the usual assumption that people in urban areas are healthier and more prosperous than their rural counterparts. The report says that cities are divided between the wealthy who benefit from urban life and the poor people living in slums and squatter settlements. It claimed that people living in slums struggle to get decent health, education, and employment.
The Saudi authorities will carry out a post-mortem examination on the bodies of two Saudi men believed to have hanged themselves at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. The father of one of the men claims his son died in a scuffle between inmates and prison guards and says he would not have killed himself. The allegation has not been independently corroborated. The U.S. said the two Saudis and a third inmate from Yemen died in a so-called, what they call a suicide pact.
Prosecution demanded the death penalty for Saddam Hussein in its closing arguments today, saying he showed no mercy in the killings of women and children during a crackdown on Shiite Muslims in the 1980s. After a three-week recess, the defense gets to sum up its case. Then a panel of judges will begin weighing the fate of the ousted leader and his seven co-defendants. U.S. officials close to the court said judges could take around 60 days in a deliberation, meaning the verdicts could likely be announced in late September or early October. If Saddam is convicted and sentenced to death by hanging, it could be months before the verdict could be carried out. The defendants have the right of appeal, and Saddam faces a second trial for the military campaign against the Iraqi Kurds in the 1980s that killed some 100,000 people.
An internal memo from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad leaked to the Washington Post reveals that the situation in the Iraqi capital is far more dire than portrayed by the Bush administration. The memo mentions that one Arab newspaper editor is preparing an extensive study of how ethnic cleansing is now occurring in almost every Iraqi province. One Iraqi employee of the embassy said that he attends a funeral every evening. Neighborhoods in Baghdad are now mostly controlled by the militias. Islamic groups are enforcing strict social codes, too. Women are increasingly being pressured to cover their faces, and it's also now considered dangerous for men and children to wear shorts outside. Iraqis working in the U.S. Embassy must now keep their place of work a secret even from their own family because of anti-American sentiments is so high there. The memo from the U.S. Embassy was sent to was sent to Washington last week ahead of President Bush's visit to Baghdad.
A newly released Pentagon study reveals that U.S. forces held Iraqi detainees for up to 7 days at a time in cells so tiny they could neither stand nor lie down. The cells measured 4 feet high, 4 feet long, and 20 inches wide. One Iraqi detainee alleged his captors duct-taped his mouth and nose before placing him into the box-like cell. The Pentagon investigation also determined that some Iraqi detainees were fed only bread and water for up to 17 days, during which time they were chained to the floor of their cells. Other Iraqis were stripped naked, deprived of sleep, and assailed with loud music. The Pentagon report was completed in November 2004, but only made public last week in response to a Freedom of Information request from the American Civil Liberties Union. The report's author, Army Brigadier General Richard Formica, determined that the troops used unauthorized interrogation methods that violated the Geneva Convention, but he recommended that no U.S. troops be disciplined for abusing Iraqis.
The U.S. Army has charged three soldiers in connection with deaths of three Iraqis who were in military custody in northern Iraq last month, the military said today. And the multinational Corps Iraq said three members of the 3rd Brigade Combat Team, 101st Airborne Division, has been charged in connection with the deaths of three male detainees during an operation near Tharthar Canal in northern Salahuddin province on May 9th. It said that a criminal investigation began May 17th and was ongoing. The investigation was requested by Lieutenant General Peter W. Chiarelli, commander of the multinational forces in Iraq, who acted after other soldiers raised suspicions about the deaths.
The African Union will send a team to Somalia to assess the possibility of deploying peacekeepers in the troubled Horn of Africa nation. The assessment team will decide on how many troops will be needed. The Islamic Courts militia seized power from the warlords in the Somali's capital, Mogadishu, have protested against the idea. Joshua Kilempa reports.
The Somali interim parliament sitting in Baidoa have also passed a resolution asking the AU to deploy forces to keep peace. The resolution has been backed by the Somali interim president, Abdullahi Yusuf, who has urged the African Union to deploy forces sooner than later.
It is essential that we ask for assistance from our African brothers because our first priority is security.
The move is unpopular among the Somalis who see the Islamic Court Union now in charge. Some of the Somalis I've talked to are against any deployment of foreign forces in Somalia.
For me, I can't tell you my name, but I don't need foreign troops to cross our border or our country, because they will destroy our country and they will take our property, such as gold, fishes, anything of importance which we needed. As they destroyed our country before, in 1992, the American soldiers has entered and they have destroyed Dahir Awil Abdi. Hussein has said, I supported Islamic Court, who has captured the capital city of Somalia, Mogadishu. They will bring for us peaceful. Foreign troops, if they have entered in Somalia, they will not bring for us any peaceful.
Ethiopia has been accused of sending 300 Ethiopian soldiers into the town of Dolo, a claim flattered made by Ethiopia. Ethiopia has had ties with Somalia's president, whose authority is now under threat following the growing influence of the Islamic Court Union. Reports say two of the Somali warlords defeated in the fighting in Mogadishu have fled the country. Bashir Rage and Musa Sudi Yala both part of a coalition formed to fight the Islamic militia earlier in the year, are said to have left Mogadishu by boat. Reports suggest that the two men boarded a U.S. vessel off the coast of Somalia. Last week, the U.S. convened an international meeting to discuss their future strategy on Somalia. Somalia has not had an effective government since 1991, and an interim government established in 2004 has been too weak to enter the capital. Washington has long viewed Somalia as a potential shelter for international terrorists. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chaimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The quartet of Middle East peace negotiators, which includes representatives from the European Union, the U.S., and the United Nations, and Russia, has approved a plan for aid to the Palestinians. Menar Hiblin reports.
The aid package could release over $120 million for a variety of programs, including the healthcare, fuel supplies, and direct aid to needy families. The World Bank and the European Union will manage the funding along with the office of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, bypassing the Hamas-led government. The European Union's External Relations Commissioner, Penny Tafirir-Waldner, will travel to the region today to discuss the details of the agreement. The European Union envoy will meet separately with President Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, but not with members of Hamas. Although the aid package will fund some critical programs, it will not solve the overall financial crisis, as it will not provide funding for the unpaid salaries of tens of thousands of government workers. Under the terms of the agreement, aid could begin flowing by early July. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Gangs in El Salvador and throughout Central America and the United States have grown and expanded in recent years due to the effects of civil wars in the region. Groups of at-risk youth live out the results of social inequality, poverty, and unemployment, and are often drawn to gangs as a way to get ahead in life. Richard Martinez reports from Guazapa, El Salvador.
The Salvadorian government recently informed it will increase the budget a total of $14 million to combat delinquency, especially the issue of murders of young gangs. These resources will be designated for the scientific and technical laboratory work of the National Civilian Police. After 1 year of implementing his Zero Tolerance program, Mano Dura, and anti-maras laws, President Antonio Saca's administration has failed to solve the social problem of gangs. The government promotes repression and criminalization instead of giving opportunities to youth, because point out young people to be investigated just looking on the suspicious.
Those kids came to get involved in all of this, in everything here. And really, they were killing kids from here. And we didn't want them to kill the kids here. And that's why we joined the MARA.
MARA Salvatrucha, or MS, was created in the 1980s by Central Americans fleeing wars at home. Many ended up in ghettos in the United States. Francisco is a former member of the Mara Salvatruch, or the MS gang, in El Salvador. In 2000, he killed a rival gang member for entry into MS. He now lives in a rural community in northeast El Salvador with his wife and child.
Ya estuve preso, ya, man. Tuve tres años.
I've already served 3 years in a juvenile detention center, twice. And I've gotten out of all that thing, but I'm still in a treatment program that I need to complete, and I have to go to school. I was detained for aggravated homicide.
With a population of 6 million, El Salvador is the second poorest country in Central America. This small nation has a 64% youth unemployment rate. As a result, Salvadorian youth turns to gangs. Many civil rights groups say the youth murder rate has risen recently due to the government's failure to address the social issue. Beatrice de Carrillo is the ombudswoman of El Salvador. She believes that the solution should be education, employment, and opportunities for young people, not criminalization. Instead, Rodrigo Avila is the director of the National Civilian Police. He says there is no way to tolerate any MARA gang members on the streets.
It's impossible that totally antisocial conduct from people that accept crime as a normal thing have a place in a society that does nothing against them.
No se haga nada contra ellos. In 2005 year, President Antonio Saca implemented a zero-tolerance policy. More than 16,000 people have been arrested since, but not at all gang members, just someone identified as dangerous. Zero tolerance has been criticized for not providing rehabilitation for youth before and after jail. According to the official results, more than 1,300 people die a year as a result of gang violence. Civilian organizations demand that the government open channel of dialogue with the gangs to come up with a peaceful solution to the cycle of violence. They propose the creation of employment opportunities, recreational and middle and higher educational centers as first steps in confronting the insecurity of the streets. Lorena Cuerno, civil rights activist, concluded.
Son dos procesos difíciles, pero yo creo que la base fundamental.
I think that the fundamental base is education. It's educating the civil population to eradicate that fear that we have of the other human beings who also cry and do what other human beings do, and to educate young gang members and gangs to stop fearing the civil population, and then they can join together and have a positive dialogue.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ricardo Martinez in El Salvador.
Chile's Supreme Court has squashed lawyers' intense attempts to make public the names of torturers from the era of the military dictatorship of Pinochet. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports.
In 2004, then-President Ricardo Lagos imposed a 50-year ban in the naming and publication of alleged torturers and violators of human rights during the Pinochet regime. The lawyers wanted the names be made public so that charges could be filed against the alleged torturers. But former President Lagos decreed that only the courts would know the names of the alleged torturers. Former President Lagos created the Prison and Torture Commission to shed light on the identities of Chileans who were detained for political reasons or were victims of torture by state agents during the 17 years of the Augusto Pinochet military dictatorship. The commission turned in a report to former President Lagos in November 2004 after 12 months of work, where the commission interviewed victims of prison and torture across Chile as well as overseas. The more than 35,000 victims who gave verifiable testimony were given a lifetime pension, in addition to free health care to the victims and their families, and free post-secondary education. But the Supreme Court ruling will protect the names of torturers for the next 50 years. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The Bolivian government has announced a $7 billion plan to create jobs and reduce poverty. The government aims to introduce more basic public services and generate 100,000 jobs a year for the next 5 years. It will be funded by income from the recently nationalized gas industry, plus international lending and foreign investment.
Burundi's last active rebel group, the Hutu National Liberation Forces, or FLNL, has signed a permanent ceasefire deal with the government. Both parties agreed to end hostilities over the next 2 weeks following talks mediated by South Africa. About 300,000 people died over 10 years of fighting between ethnic Hutus and Tutsis.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, Juneteenth, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032. Leave a message on extension 203 or send email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 on Translator K264AA in Hood River at 91.9 on Translator K220HR. And you can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is Rochelle Koivunen. Special thanks to reporters Rochelle Koivunen and Jacob Finston. Our engineers are Brian Averill and Yves Sokolai. This evening, the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving, and I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with Radio Dog Cosmo. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., of course, is the KBOO Morning News. And then at 7:30, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. And then at 9 on Between the Covers, host Marianne Barsuknik interviews historian, broadcaster, and writer Simone Chama, who is the author of Rough Crossings, Britain, the Slaves, and the American Revolution. Then at 9:30, Julie Sabatier interviews David Bloom, an international ethanol expert whose forthcoming book is called Alcohol Can Be a Gas. At 10 a.m., hear a special edition of Station Studio featuring Crime Pays, an award-winning look at who's getting rich from U.S. prisons. And then at 11, of course, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, handcrafted, listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us. And one last note. The KBOO News Department is making room for more volunteer reporters and news producers. So if you're computer proficient, are you a natural organizer, do you want to undo the news spins, well then, and do you have some free time? Well then, call Lisa Loving at 503-231-8032 at extension 203. Ciao.
This is Independent Native News for Monday, the 19th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A new study has concluded that crowded homes among the Inuit lead to an increase in violence. As Craig McCulloch reports, the study focused on one small area in the territory of Nunavut in Canada's far north.
The report finds increased amounts of violence and domestic abuse among Inuit communities are directly linked to overcrowded living conditions. Done last summer, it looks at the community of Cape Dorset, with a population of 1,200 in the south coast of Canada's Baffin Island. Many residents share living space with 5 to 12 relatives. 26% of respondents say people being angry is the biggest problem they face living in a crowded house. 17% say drug use and 15% cite depression. Likewise, 30% of respondents believe anger problems could be eliminated with more spacious living conditions. 20% say school problems could be reduced, while 15% believe violence would decrease. The same survey finds 66 active cases of tuberculosis and half of the respondents unemployed. Frank Tester, a sociology professor at the University of British Columbia, is the organizer of the report. He hopes it will give real examples of problems faced by overcrowding among Canada's Inuit and First Nations.
Hopefully the work that we did in the community, and I should say that, you know, young people in the community were, I trained them as researchers and they did a lot of the work, but hopefully the research will have an impact on the way people think about and understand the relationship between housing conditions and problems like domestic violence.
Tester says the quickest solution is to build more houses. He says the Canadian government must increase funding for Inuit and First Nations housing, and doing so will reduce a myriad of problems. Rates of sexual assaults are 13 times, and other assaults are 9 times higher in Nunavut than in the rest of Canada. For Independent Native News, I'm Craig McCulloch.
A husband and wife photography team from Seattle has been photographing dance festivals and powwows for more than 16 years. Some of their best portraits are now on display in Moscow, Idaho. Correspondent Tom Bonzi has details.
We do more of this now than commercial work. We enjoy it. It's just our way of life right now. We're kind of powwow people. We know more Indian people than we do our own people.
Tomorrow's powwow trail overlaps with the Lewis and Clark Trail. Many of their subjects belong to Northwest tribes the explorers met.
The continuity of passing on traditions and the importance of that, and the strong sense of identity and heritage, and that just, it was so enriching to us. It just moved us deeply, and we got to know so many people that, so now we're into two generations that were, because we've done this for so long, that some of the kids that we photographed in the beginning were now shooting their children.
We're welcomed now a lot more, and we're known a lot more. Early on, it was more difficult. We've never seen anybody give us any trouble, and we've been to some powwows, little country powwows, where we'll look around and we're the only white people there.
Well, this is one of my favorite photographs of all time, and I remember it so vividly. This is Mary, Jennifer, and Joyce. Everybody talks about is their last name. And they are Blackfeet and Colville. And they're all standing in their very beautiful buckskin regalia and looking directly into the camera, and they're just precious.
38 vibrant photos are now on display. The exhibit, Faces from the Land, runs through August 11th at the 3rd Street Gallery in Moscow, Idaho. The exhibit opening coincides with the Nez Perce Tribe's Lewis and Clark Bicentennial event. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian Country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org.
It's 6 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Labor Radio.